Hello and welcome to a football podcast. My name is Devang Desai. I'm joined by the usual suspects, David Goss and Nick Andrade. On today's show, we chat Thierry Henry staying in Montreal, a massive weekend for the Toffees. We're joined by Lori Lindsay to talk She Believes Cup. Plus, it's your questions on Ask AFP. Gentlemen, how are we doing? David, how are you, sir?
Fantastic. Huge weekend. I think anyone who's in the Discord knows I put in. I'm a little worried that neither of you would even show up for the show. Big weekend of soccer action, some big results. And so I was just here sitting in the cold, just ingesting all of it as it came through.
To our veins, our collective veins, it's true. David was going off in the Discord. We were going off for the Milan Derby. The Man City win over Arsenal did not really affect me. The fact that it was only 1-0, it was one of those sad, sad victories where we weren't...
It was a moral victory.
The first 10 minutes in, I'm like, okay, it might be 8-0. We're looking at an 8-0, 9-0 situation just based on how ruthless they looked and the fact that Raheem Sterling scored a header in our box, which shouldn't happen, right? But things do happen, Nick. Don't they? Don't they, Nick? Things happen.
I was recording a podcast with Devang yesterday, and throughout the podcast, he just kept mentioning, oh, it's still 1-0. Oh, it's still 1-0. And I was just laughing in my head, like, this is the moral victories that we're having at this point.
Speaking of, how was your weekend, sir?
It was okay. Honestly, I felt, I don't know. This is probably the lowest point at this point. I remember Peter Drury on the broadcast was saying, like, the last time Everton beat Liverpool, it was 1999, and some of the players on the team are now 58 years old. And I'm just thinking, like, okay, thank you. Just dig deeper, man. Dig deeper. This is just embarrassing. You see Jordan Henderson, he gets injured, and then it just, ugh. My heart. But I just, at this point now, I feel like I'm Devang, where I'm just apathetic in terms of, like, this season is over, but I'm just praying top four, make it happen.
Oh, man.
But they just can't score. See, I don't know what it is.
It's funny, you're doing the Arsenal, like, 10 year abyss really, yes, condensed into time, into like the last 6 months where it's like, okay, top four is good now. Top four, that's all we need. Top four and we're good. Yep. Couple of things. Kabak, my guy, is not 6'1". There's no way. I know it's listed. He's 6'1", but he does not look 6'1" to me. And I felt a single tear went down my face when he got turned by that James through ball to Richarlison, because there's no coming back from that. And as soon as that happened, I was like, this is going to be a bad day for Liverpool. But Peter Drury must have had a lot of stuff in the bag for that game, because literally from the pregame to the final minute, he had anecdotes coming out of every which way. It was a tour de force, to be honest, of the announcer.
I remember especially too, I was watching with my girlfriend, and my girlfriend goes, I think it was a free kick with James, and then he's like, does he dare? And then he takes a shot, he dares! And my girlfriend was just dying. It's just, he has all these anecdotes. Like, he has, I don't know if he has everything written down. He must have, right?
So this is my question. Does he have writers? He must. I think he must have writers.
I think
unless he's
all
writing
him.
All of this material. I don't know, man. Some of these soliloquies, some of these intros to these games are penned by the bard himself, it feels like. But I love Pete. Yes. He brings
he's
it.
He's like almost Shakespeare.
He's got the writing room.
If we can get him on the show one day, my first question to him will be, do you have a writing team, Pete? Because they're fantastic. I love the energy he brings.
So I will say, to Nick's point of the close and like the bringing context to the moment, it reaches a point where they overkill it, where you're like, we get it. This is unprecedented and is a big deal.
Huge.
And they keep adding in the, like, this is the first time that Liverpool have been this low in the table at this date, and this is the least points they've had, and this is how many points they had last year. And it was like, no, I'm pretty sure over the first 30 minutes you'd establish that Liverpool are not as good this year and they're struggling currently. This is the fourth time after they've not lost a game for 17 months at home. And you're like, oh, okay. Yeah, no, we're aware. Like, we're there. You don't need to keep proving it.
It kills me because it's been used for a bunch of teams. I think Arteta got it too when Arsenal was in that bad run, like consecutive home losses in a row. I'm like, this doesn't mean anything. There's no one in the stands. It literally does not have any sort of factor on what is happening on the pitch itself.
Null and void the season, boys. That's all I gotta say. It's over. Who cares?
Devang, you Good still Lord. Have to protect the lads, and you've got to protect home ground. Got to put it in row Z when you need to.
I I just looked up Peter Drury on Twitter to see if he had a Twitter account, but he doesn't. But there's three Twitter accounts that come up. Peter Drury, it says football poet. Peter Drury quotes, tribute account to the great Peter football poet Drury, and yep. then poetic Peter Drury. So basically everyone calls him a poet, so he is.
As if you needed any more confirmation of how much of a G Pete Drury is, he's not on Twitter, proving he might be the sanest of us all. Checkmate, sir. Checkmate. A reminder, we're on Patreon, getting closer to our goal. We will release more one-on-one interviews as we approach the CPL season, the MLS season. Those would be really cool. So join us on Patreon today. You get the show ad-free. You get to join us on the Discord. A lively weekend, of course, with the Milan Derby, which we'll get to. Very fun match. Very, you know, when things you hope to see happen, happen, David? That happened in that match for me.
Yeah, Devang, it's exactly what you want to see. And then it was nice to feel everyone be on board for it, right? Like everyone's in the Discord chat and everyone's like, yes, Lukaku's dominant. Yes, he's here. He's a guy you have to root for. And so when he's succeeding, it's nice to feel everyone succeed with him together, right?
It's facts. It's 100% facts. Head over to patreon.com/afootballpodcast and join us today after the break. A condensed headlines. North America, Europe, we got it all coming up on AFP. Welcome back to a football podcast. We begin with the big coaching news coming out of Montreal. Thierry Henry will not be joining Bournemouth, at least this season. Jonathan Woodgate will see the cherries through to the rest of the year. They're doing well currently after they fired their manager earlier this season. David, I think the Patrick Vieira to TFC stuff obviously was a hot topic in my neck of the woods. And the big concern always was going to be, would Patrick be lured somewhere else? Even if he came to Toronto, would his long-term interest be drawn away by a European club? And I think once this smoke started to gather around Thierry Henry to Bournemouth, maybe some of those concerns that TFC fans were confirmed. But Thierry's going to stay. I'm curious if you think this is the right move for him.
It wasn't an obvious move to me when the rumor came up. Like, okay, yeah, this makes sense, right? Sort of like Patrick Vieira to Nice, where once it came up, you were like, this is an up-and-coming club. He's an up-and-coming coach. It's France. It's a first-division team. It makes sense. It gets done. This one, I think, was a little bit of a question mark because it's tough to come into a situation like that where it has to be win now, and it's the championship where you don't have much time to develop your style. And for Thierry Henry, again, because he got mentioned in this job, he's at a place where he's still going to get interviews and mentioned for any job he wants. And I know he was on the shortlist for Barcelona and there's that connection there with him, but not everyone's on that shortlist, right? Not everyone gets there. So I still think he can get a good job if he spends another year in Montreal, if that's what he wants. And I don't know that Bournemouth is the best job he can get. So it didn't seem to make a ton of sense. And it makes sense that he's coming back. Although the question mark that I have, Devang, is for him, if he gets this opportunity, it's not like Montreal's making it easy on him. One, they can't host games and that's not Montreal's fault. And two, they're not one of the higher spending teams in MLS as teams spend more and more. So it's not like it's obvious for him to come back and say, well, I'll crush it this year and then I'll get an even better offer next year.
Yeah, to be honest, I'm a bit of two minds. Like, I don't think Bournemouth would be the best situation for him to jump into to the championship with where he's at compared to how long he's had in Montreal and the ability to lay some groundwork and build his system and get his players to play the way he wants to play. He won't be afforded that time with Bournemouth. But is it worth sticking around somewhere where you're not quite sure what the end product is going to be or how committed your bosses are to that end product? So I think Thierry Henry even taking this offer, taking this interview, is a sign probably for the Saputo family to realize that he's definitely not staying forever, but he might not stay much longer in this current year if maybe they don't get more serious about things. But I don't think they're going to financially shock everyone, right, David? So it might be a holding pattern for everyone involved for now.
And I think we're both people who've watched this league for a while and we talk about, you know, MLS a lot, and we don't think you have to spend to win, but when you look at the league, they have one designated player. It's an aging Victor Wanyama, who I'm not even sure should be a starter on their team right now. They are so far off what other teams are doing. Again, Nashville was successful last year. I like what the Colorado Rapids have built. FC Dallas have done things differently. Orlando have as well, although they also went out and got Nani. There's different ways to build it. but there is a clear lack of financial support in the first team for Thierry Henry that the teams around him don't have to deal with.
We're super excited to watch Jordan Morris with Swansea City. Unfortunately, this weekend, disastrous news. Jordan Morris suffered significant ligament damage to his ACL. His season is over. Steve Cooper, the manager at Swansea, quoted, "It's the end of his season for us and a long road back to recovery for Jordan. It's very cruel." David, it's a huge year for Jordan Morris. I think not just making the move to England, but also I think like in the national team sense, he was trying to get more reps and firmly cement himself as an option. It's quite sad to see this come down.
It's a life-changing moment for him yesterday, which I think is what sucked. I wasn't watching the game. I was actually watching Barnsley play at the same time because Daryl Dike was starting and he played fairly well in that game, and then saw it, you know, immediately go out all over Twitter. And your first thought is just, it hurts for him. He came back from ACL injury. He's come back from big injuries. He did everything he had to do at Seattle. He'd reached such a high peak. I mean, he was one of the most fun players to watch in MLS over the last year and a half. Some of the dominant performances he had, ripping San Jose apart by himself. And he was a starter on the national team because of the level he was performing at. And then he took this risk and took this opportunity to go to Europe now. And at 26, this was probably it for him. There's a small window in which he comes back healthy, plays really well next year, starts at a World Cup for the US if they qualify. And coming out of that at 28... yeah, okay, maybe he could still get a shot going to Europe. I don't know if he'll want to, but this was kind of that big moment, that one opportunity. And so it's unfortunate to see what's happened to him. You'd hope for him, he's been through this before, so he knows that he can come out of it on the other side. And the one sliver of the nice part about it is because he's on loan from Seattle, he can go back to Seattle and take care of this where he's done it before, where he knows he's getting the support he needs, where he's been successful. So the hope is we see him in 2022 playing at a high level, but this was brutal. And I think there's a space in which Jordan Morris has a great career and is happy with the things he's accomplished and doesn't play in Europe, or doesn't play in Europe for a long time, where some other players, that's all they ever wanted to accomplish. I don't think he's one of those guys. But I think from the national team point of view, he may not do things that the national team needs, but he was playing at such a high level. He was a starter. And so now he loses that spot for a year. It might be tough for him to get back in as a starter for that group. And that's unfortunate because he'd really earned it.
Match of the weekend, the Milan derby, Inter Milan. Boy, oh boy, everything is well with Antonio Conte's side. 4 points clear of AC Milan after a 3-0 victory at the San Siro. Lautaro Martinez, a brace, Romelu Lukaku, the dagger, a fantastic dagger in the 66th minute. David, we watched this game real time, highlighted it, circled it. Because I think the scoreline was surprising. But I think for me, I think with everything you hear with Inter Milan, and not to say that it's constant crisis, but I think Antonio Conte's abilities as a coach sometimes get lost within the madness that's associated with him. And then when you watch his team play out the back like they did, watch Hakimi ball out like he did, watch Barella ball out like he did, realize that Christian Eriksen can still play and is not completely washed. It makes you remember that Antonio Conte knows what he's doing sometimes, and that this game is pretty dumb as well.
It definitely left me with the feeling that the only team that can beat Inter Milan for the Serie A title is Inter Milan. Exactly. Like, you watch this game and nothing Milan could do made Inter fearful defensively, look unstable, or stop them offensively. But that should be the case every game, and it's not. And it's all to what you just said, which is the chaos that surrounds it. I mean, this was the biggest game of the year, and Christian Eriksen started, what, 3 weeks after he was unplayable and had to leave the club for free because he was unusable. Like, this is the chaos that Conte has built, and the team, when they play this way, are so good and so fun to watch. To think, why don't they play this way all the time?
Yeah. I feel like Perisic is a good person, like a good example of this, where I think people rightly rave about him and say, like, he's a fantastic player, and you could see him being a difference maker in that game. But Perisic, over the course of this season, has not been at that level, right? But you get this level of performance in the game that mattered. On the flip side, I think you have to be frank about the assessment with AC Milan. This is a massive disappointment in terms of what they've been able to do this season and the resurgence, the renaissance of this famed club, this club that rightfully deserves to be back at the top. I think they firmly realize they can be at the top, but to to lose the way they did in this game, David. I wonder if that sets back the project a bit.
I think it kind of, it gives you an idea of where they stand, right? Like, they are not good enough, because we haven't seen them in Champions League. We've only seen them in Europa League, to go against a team of this quality and control the game in any way. And so when Inter stepped off and allowed Milan the ball a bit, they didn't have an ability, they didn't have ideas of how to break them down. And when Inter wanted to turn it on, they could, right? So at no point was this Milan's game plan was dominating and they were the ones who were dictating how this game was played. And so I think that's kind of where Milan stands in the world. The question was, did they have enough to sneak a title win this year in Italy with the way other teams are performing? And it doesn't feel that way. Bennacer is a huge loss for them. And I think you felt that in this game was, if he's in there, maybe Milan can dominate midfield. It frees up Kessie a little bit more to cover some ground. And they just didn't have that dominant force in midfield. And so you take that away and Milan are, or Inter are more dangerous up top. They're more steady at the back. And then Perisic and Hakimi at wingbacks. I mean, that might be the best pairing in the world if they can play that way. So it definitely showed the quality in Inter, the depth in Inter, and kind of the lack of it for Milan. And going forward, it again, as I was joking, but serious, this is Inter Milan's title unless they shoot themselves in the foot. And this feels like a group that will shoot themselves in the foot.
Jeez. Damn, I mean, it's scathing, but show me the lie. Show me the lie. Prove me wrong. Prove us wrong, Inter Milan.
But you brought it up in the beginning. We didn't talk about it as much, Devang. Lukaku.
Yeah.
I mean, man, this is man, who he man, is. Man. He is a guy you play through. He's a goal scorer. He's physical. He's intelligent. He's everything. Man, you just didn't let him do it. And I think we brought it up a week or two ago. Like, when will the perception of him change? And if it hasn't already, then that's people who don't watch soccer.
I think it was this weekend too. Like, the last people holding on to the BS beliefs that they may have, or the anger of maybe of what went down at Manchester United, etc. Like, let it go. He's great. It's absolutely great. What a performance. We go to England. The match of the weekend was Liverpool-Everton, but I don't think the match itself was. And we were talking about Pichuri, but he definitely gave it the kiss of death. I think it was the 20th minute and it was 1-0. And he's like, it's 1-0, but you better believe there's plenty of goals left in this game. And there were not. It was literally not happening. So I think for once, and we don't talk about them nearly enough considering I like them quite much, West Ham, David, is a Champions League contender. It is not a lie. David Moyes is doing the damn thing. And I think even me, the curmudgeon himself, have to smile watching David Moyes right some wrongs, particularly after getting his dream job and not having it quickly afterwards, getting another chance to make a pretty big, big stamp on the league with his West Ham team.
Wait, this one's for the haters. David Moyes doing it with Jesse Lingard on loan, shining as the attacking force of this team. Lord. That's open buffet for haters everywhere.
With Jesse Lingard against Jose Mourinho, who he had never beaten. Think about the everything that had to come together for this moment to occur.
No, it was amazing. And this is a West Ham group. And I think it's sort of like what we talked about with Everton, which is their best 11 is competitive against anyone. When Mikel Antonio's not there, it's a question mark. And so that's coming down the end. I think the next 3 weeks, they've got City away, Leeds United at home, Man U away. You're going to learn a lot about this team. If they can get through that with 5-6 points, still be sitting in a Champions League spot, they've got a clean run to close out the year to get all the way to a Champions League. And with the way Suchek plays and the way the backline's played and Mikel Antonio when he's healthy, they've got enough talent to compete at that level. But if they lose one of those pieces, they don't have the depth to cover it. And so that's kind of going to be the question mark for this group going forward.
Making smart buys from teams that are relegated, an underrated part of the gig, but Craig Dawson, who they brought over from Watford, has been massive. And you're finding a center back, 30 years old, has played a ton of games in the Premier League. Just bring him over and slot him in, no questions asked. That's a big thing. And I love Suchek. Absolutely love Suchek. He's big Thomas Rosicki, David. Do you believe it? The comp? Not just because they're Czech, but the work rate, the vision. He's smart, super smart with the ball at his feet. Love to watch him. Quickly, The Jack Grealish thing I found is fascinating. It was leaked beforehand that Jack Grealish would not be involved in the Aston Villa-Leicester game. Apparently, the club has now banned their players from playing fantasy football because a bunch of them took out Grealish the night before from their lineup because they knew he wasn't going to play. A, this is madness, but B, what?
In this entire story, I've just been lost. Like, I don't have a take. I don't feel anything strong. This is one of the weirdest things that's ever happened.
Moving on. There is a race in Germany. There is, David. After, again,
I've asked for it for months.
Another country where we've declared no race to be had, there is one, and it's Bayern Munich not doing well. Eintracht Frankfurt, 2-1 victory, opens up the race because Leipzig recovered from a pretty poor showing against Liverpool, you could say. I don't think, especially this Liverpool, and Leipzig on the upward trajectory. You would want to see them do better in European play. My boy, Marcel Sabitzer, who I declared my love for on Twitter, promptly gave the ball away to Mo Salah maybe seconds later. But Marcel. Goal of the year candidate this weekend to prove that Leipzig, David, is now just 2 points back and very much for real in this race.
I would like to say that I have been questioning Bayern this whole time, but my issue was no team would step up to chase them. And that had been the problem as Leverkusen and Dortmund and Gladbach had fallen off, felt like it was kind of there for Bayern to take. And I know Nick's a big Eintracht fan. Kostic, again, being dominant down that left wing, arguably the most dangerous player in the world right now, or the best outlet, you could say. And then Leipzig going to Hertha, and obviously a struggling Hertha team, but so much talent in that group. And it was a classic Leipzig performance, which I think was big coming off the Liverpool game, where they shot themselves in the foot in a high press game, which is what Leipzig wants to play. So it's almost like they lost their game in midweek. And so to come back this weekend and to play at the tempo you want to play at, get some big moments. Both of the players who made huge mistakes, Sabitzer and Nkunku, who made the mistake on the Mane goal, both of them scored in this game. You saw Olmo have a good game as well. So it was big to see, I think, everyone bounce back and kind of, now you're 2 points back and it's the perfect way to turn the page for this club and say, no, we still have something to play for and fight for going forward.
The little energy drinks that could. Love to see a small minnow get a chance to take a swipe at the Giants like Bayern Munich. We end in Spain, and we're going to cover the UCL in one shot as well. Another place where Atletico Madrid looked very comfortable, and maybe too comfortable in hindsight. A 2-0 loss to Levante, and now look who's coming. Zinedine Zidane's Real Madrid trail by 3 points. Atletico sells a game in hand, but David, Real Madrid putting out a bench featuring Isco and some guys basically get what they needed from Valladolid. Casemiro basically scores once every couple like months-ish, but every goal he scores is massive, huge for them. It's crazy how it happens, but it is a true fact. And Luka Modric continues to turn back the clock. I think we'll focus on Atletico though, because they play Chelsea. David, I think things looked pretty damn good for them, right? Not too long ago. What has changed?
They had a large COVID outbreak in their group. And so for a while it was, well, what are the lineups that we can put together? And I think you're seeing that way on this group. Just, they didn't even have a full bench again this week. Dembele, who they brought in for a little bit of depth, finally gets back into the team. And you watch this game and they were so dynamic the last few weeks. I mean, they would give up goals and it didn't matter because they were going to score three or four. And then you have a game like this where João Felix couldn't get it going. Suarez wasn't getting looks. And so you can kind of see that it's weighing on the legs of these players. And it's tough because this is kind of their moment in Champions League, because it felt like they were so far ahead in the league that they were cruising and they could focus on Champions League. And now they're kind of in an emergency situation on both sides, and they don't really have that one player, because Felix isn't there yet, to drag them out of that. And so they need to, as a group, play at a high level, and they need 10, 11 players doing that, and they haven't had that over the last few weeks. And then you even see on the final goal they concede in this game against Levante, everyone goes up for the corner. Okay, that's fine. It's a counterattack. You need to win. The goal doesn't matter. But the mistake from Llorente to play a low pass with his goalkeeper in the attacking box, rather than just loop it into the corner and let your team sort of recover, like those are those moments where it would never happen to a Simeone team. So it's going to be fascinating to see, can they turn that around going into Champions League this week? Because they should be favorites against Chelsea, but Chelsea have settled themselves. And this is a team that Madrid can't assume they're going to win, right? They have to play well. They can't just show up and get through this tie.
I'll conclude with my most banterific statement of this podcast, but I wonder how long it's going to take for Thomas Tuchel to figure out which players he should use. I wonder how many games more. I wonder how many times he's going to have to make a sub or take Hudson-Odoi off. He put him on in that second half. I wonder how well that's going to go over in the continued weeks.
Are you picking them to beat Atletico?
I'm not. I'm picking things to get rocky at Chelsea, but rocky, not rocky enough to derail a top four. But I think the man management aspect and the fact that their squad is so big, is going to come with it some interesting situations.
Well, every American would agree with you because every American is panicked right now. Every time Christian Pulisic, even though he's injured now, doesn't get a full 90.
Like, didn't they know each other at Dortmund? I thought they were boys.
Yeah, love to see it. Love to see the hand wringing. It's like, relax, guys. So you have 40 kids playing in the top leagues everywhere.
But we do have to say for Real Madrid, you mentioned it, Casemiro, Modric, Cruz, they've all turned back the clock.
The old guys are doing it.
Yeah.
And they're doing it from their boss, perhaps.
Exactly. But Zidane comes in, they win Champions League. He leaves, everything goes to shit. He comes back, they win Champions League. Now everything goes to shit. And he says, oh, I need my players to step up. And they do it. And this weekend was without Benzema. And so he should be back coming into Champions League. And so now you've got the second best center forward, third best center forward in the world, whatever. Plus that midfield, you still got Vinicius. Like, this is, I think there was a moment this year where it was like, wow, Barcelona's a joke and Real Madrid's bad. And so now it's like those two are off and you can forget about them and they're not relevant, where this is still a stacked Real Madrid team. And if it's not this year, it's next year. Like, they're going to win a title, one of their titles in the next 2 years, whether it's Copa del Rey, Champions League, or La Liga. That's just how this club operates.
You calling him Vinicius or Vinny Jr.? Are you on the Vinny Jr. or Vinny?
No, I'm a Vinicius guy. No. I was like 1 week away, by the way, from covering. Yeah. I think we actually have a question in the mailbag about GA Cup, about covering him at GA Cup before Real Madrid signed him for 45 million euros, which means you don't have to play in youth tournaments in Texas.
That is fascinating. I mean, we'll cover that at the end of the show, but that tie, Atalanta-Real Madrid, probably the one of the midweek Champions League fixtures, but of course, Atletico-Chelsea as well, Lazio-Bayern Munich, Manchester City now going for the real trophy for them, which is super weird to say as they lead the Premier League, but their UCL quest continues against Borussia Mönchengladbach. Enjoy that action, but coming up after the break, She Believes Cup, well underway. Canada taking on the U.S. last week. We got into it with former U.S. women's national team player and current broadcaster Lori Lindsay coming up on A Football Podcast. Welcome back to A Football Podcast. We're joined today by former U.S. women's national team member and current broadcaster at the She Believes Cup, Lori Lindsay. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be on. Good to be chatting with you all today.
Lori, you're doing double duty on the international feed, broadcasting the play-by-play and the color commentary. How is that going so far?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I love the work. It's awesome. So I'm having a blast. And as you just mentioned, it's a bit of a new opportunity for me, a new position to be doing both. So calling the games for the world feed solo, and all is well. I mean, listen, my goal calls. Listen, I don't typically call a goal calls. That's for the play-by-play, right? And I'm used to laying out, and clearly I am laying out during some of the goals too, because I'm like, and so my goal calls need some work. But all in all, been such a fun tournament to cover and great learning opportunity and growth period as a broadcaster.
But Lori, it's fitting because you were a box-to-box central midfielder. So now you have to do everything.
It's perfect.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. It is. It's I am gaining a greater appreciation for, I always have had a great appreciation for the play-by-play and their preparation, but I'm gaining even more appreciation for what they do and how they prepare for games. So yes, it is. Yeah, there's some big LOLs going on inside. I'm muting myself a lot, let's say, during the broadcast laughing.
So we're four games through the tournament, two remaining, but we've had the big USA-Canada clash, the Americans prevailing 1-0, Rose Lavelle off the bench with the winner. But I must ask, Laurie, my passport is in the balance if I do not ask this. Do you believe it was a handball against Perth in the second half? And do you believe Canadians are warranted in feeling aggrieved by that missed call?
Oh, listen, you know, you could argue the same thing. There was a handball on Canada in the first half. So I think, right, if you're going to call that one, it was the correct call to not call it either. You know, I'm not like huge into handballs, and I think we've gotten really, not that you shouldn't be calling them, right, if it's a clear. I just don't know if that was the deciding factor. And like, if you're going to talk about that, then you have to talk about also, sorry, Janine Becky, but you're going to have to talk about her two clear misses, right?
100%. So,
because if she would have made those two, I don't think Canada would have even been talking about that handball.
It's a good segue to what I kind of wanted to non-jokingly ask about in terms of Canada. It's the storyline is basically who is not there, and Bev Friesman's first tournament in charge, or first game in charge. And though they did lose, I think the overall signs are pretty positive. But for a team to take that next level, I think there is going to need to some game breakers emerging from this current group. But I think Janine Becky is one of them with what she does at the club level. We see it pretty often, but I think internationally we've seen some big moments in the recent past. She hasn't been able to do that in the big games, but overall it looks like she will trend towards that. I was just wondering what your view on Janine Becky is, Laurie.
Yeah, I mean, I think she is a really quality player, and I would totally agree with you in the fact that, you know, I think partially a little bit of it too is this is the first games for Canada in a year, so you expect that, and as you mentioned, quite a few big name players missing, and a lot of a new coach, a lot of players getting some of their first caps, or just a lot of inexperience. And then for Janine, as of recent, though, hasn't played a ton for Man City. So, you know, I think it takes a little bit of time in terms of continuing to work her way in. But I really appreciate what she brings just in general to the game of her movement. She finds herself in good positions. But yeah, it does seem right now, I think across the board in this tournament in particular, the general theme is a lack of execution, which again, like with the limited amount of minutes a lot of these teams have played and the players have played, that's like going to be the missing piece. And not even just for Canada, right? It's been for Brazil, it's been for the US. So for Janine, I mean, I think if that's the area that she needs to improve upon, I mean, other than that, like world-class player.
When you look at Bev Priestman as a coach, the expectations for this group, you know, not in She Believes Cup, but going forward as a program, what do you think the type of Canada team she's going to build is? Because I have to admit, knowing the players that were missing, I was surprised by how well Canada played in the first game. The energy they played with, I thought the confidence they played with against the US. But you know her better than me, her background, style of coach. What do you expect to see?
Well, first of all, I really like Bev Priestman, and I think that's a great hire for Canada, and the players know her. Obviously, she was John Herdman's assistant, and then has gone on to be Phil Neville's assistant in England, and now obviously the head coach. So I think there's a familiarity as well. And under John Herdman, this was a team that was going to fight, that was going to like make life difficult for other teams. And I anticipate Bev Priestman bringing in not only that bravery and that fight that we've typically seen, especially in the rivalry against US, and that was to be expected, but also now another layer of, you know, possession oriented. What can they do? Can they get Fleming involved more? Can she have more of an impact? Can Janine Becky have even more of an impact in like kind of like that extra bite in the final third? Obviously Diana Matheson, Christine Sinclair, but those players aren't going to be there forever. So Heidema, who's still over in France, can those players, Ashley Lawrence, again, due to the COVID-19 restrictions, still over in France with their club teams, can those players have even more of a killer instinct in the final third? And I think you'll see that under Brett Priestman as she continues to be able to lay out her vision, but also have more time with these players. So again, the fight that you've always seen with this Canadian team, but also then the addition of like the tactical understanding and just a little bit more nuance in the final third, I think is what she'll look to really to bring in.
Devang, the Jordan Huitema, Alphonso Davies couple, is that just like they're going to be prime that minister at some point?
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing. That is exactly what I'm hearing.
I hope our soccer officials aren't banking on this single-handedly lifting us to international relevancy in the football game, but I think it might. I think it might, just by sheer star power alone. I was going to say, just watching them press in that U.S. game, press the United States, which it didn't seem they did under Heinrich Moeller, and it was a breath of fresh air, even though they didn't get their results, and I thought they did play well in that game. And against Argentina, I feel like the final product, like you mentioned, Laurie, was lacking the execution, but they did get the 1-0 victory. Just to move over to the United States, as an outsider, I laugh when I see the lineup posted for your team, Laurie and David, because the replies every time is it's like a war has gone on about who should play and who shouldn't play. And I think just from a zooming out like area, there's so much talent available. I wonder what this tournament is being used to evaluate, Laurie.
Yeah, well, I think it is. I mean, it is hilarious, right? I mean, you're looking at the players that even came off the bench in that Canadian game when you're bringing on Alex Morgan, you're bringing on Kristen Press. I mean, it is unbelievable. And then you're talking about Sam Mewis and Tobin Heath not even available for the tournament due to injury. So we do have a luxury of players, and it goes even further than the 23 players that are here on this roster. I mean, the depth that we have and the players that have even been invited into a camp yet that could potentially be stars at this level as well is just mind-boggling. But in turn, I think you'll always find like who the question of who should be playing, who should not be playing. I mean, that will forever be the debate, and that's what sport is. That's what soccer is. But I think for Vlatko Andonovski, it is really about getting a clear picture of who is the best pairings across the board for this team. And it might not be the biggest name players, right? Like, cause that's always going to be changing. And I think that was highlighted a bit in the Canada game, because Canada pressed it sometimes, but then they also sat deep and it was difficult for the U.S. to find any space in behind. It was difficult for the U.S. to break them down. And you saw where, you know, Kat Macario, you know, mm-hmm. touted as one of the best for the future. And now, but she's young and she hasn't had a lot of experience at this level. And it's a lot different than playing in college, obviously, and even playing for Lyon in France. So it will take her time. And you saw that she was a non-factor in that game. So who are the best players? Who can play together? Who has the partnerships to cause the most trouble, I think, is what the clearest picture Blacko's trying to get throughout this tournament.
Laurie, you and me, obviously off air, but we've talked a lot about this national team, you know, what it can be, how it's created. And what's been most promising from what I've seen is that Vlatko wants to press high and change the game. And I don't know that was what this group did under Jill Ellis. And obviously they were successful, but it seems like the right evolution in my mind for this group because of the athleticism and the, you know, ability to play high and then create attacking chances. Am I seeing it the right way? Does that make sense to you as well?
Yeah, it does. And I think that's where always the topic is going to be, right? Because this team, athletically, I mean, there's so many good soccer players on this team, but athletically, it is so difficult for teams to keep up with us, right? With the speed that we have, this ability to score goals when needed, and really the competition. And Vlatko's even talked about this. So he's like, you know, I want to have a little bit more nuance in the final third of when, if we can't go quickly after we've pressed and won the ball, then how do we calm things down, switch the point, recycle our runs, recycle the ball? And I think that has actually been an ongoing conversation for like a decade, really, even when I was playing, that was a bit, because you have, I think it's twofold. You have different styles of players, and it depends on who you want to play and kind of what they bring to the table, right? Like some of these front runners we have, it's not it's not in their blood or DNA to be like, yeah, let me just put my foot on this ball and recycle it if it's not on, right? It's about like, hey, I want to go. I want to maximize my opportunities when I'm out here playing. And I think that also folds into the fact that there's so much competition and push to get on the field to make this 18, that sometimes when you get that chance, it's about go, 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 because you want to perform. You want to do whatever you can. And I think personally, the next level is like, yes, that is. And again, this is just me and the broadcast side of stuff now, but performing is also not just scoring goals. It's like, hey, how can you find time when it's like, hey, it is time to put our foot on the ball. I'm going to be that one to take charge. Right. And personally, I'm still curious on who that player is, because yes, we see Lindsey Horan get her foot on the ball and switch the point of attack. But other than that, and maybe a Sam Mewis sometime, we don't really, in what I've seen a player that's like calming things down, saying, hey, this, we're giving the ball away too much. Let's switch it. Right. Let's keep it. Let's find the pockets of space. We're going to switch when we need to open up centrally, or we're going to try to like run with the ball centrally to open up pockets wide. Like, I haven't seen somebody do that consistently. And then also, like, most people could be like, who cares, Lori? We're winning games. This team hasn't lost in 2 years. Like, what are you talking about, right? And,
nice problems.
And I'm like,
nice,
that's problems, a fair point as well. I just think as like the rest of the world catches up, that will have to become more pertinent in terms of layering in. I do believe that's going on behind the scenes with Flacco. It's just going to take time.
And Lori, this was the convo you and me were having going into the 2019 World Cup, right? Which was, as we can't play the soccer France plays. To me, they play the best soccer in the world on the women's side as a national team consistently, but we win. And so it's like finding that in between of, okay, well, as the game changes and identities become a thing and styles become, you know, more established, where does the US fit? And so that's, as you were saying, like, you still kind of have that in between, and there's just so much talent that it's hard to change things, and maybe it doesn't even matter at times. But it's been interesting to see the group over the last few months when they've gotten games in, of that energy and that style that they're playing, which makes sense for our talent pool.
For sure. And I you and I completely agree on this. And it is, again, it's a fine line. And it's very similar to what we're hearing Pia Sundhage, that now the Brazilian head coach for the women, talk about her team. And obviously she was the U.S. women's national team coach, and I played for her, but it's a fine line for her as well, because she's like, looks at the Brazilian team as a whole, and she's like, we need to start to bring in some younger talent, because like Marta, Cristiane, for me, these players aren't going to play forever. And but when she's like, when I look at this team, there needs to be more structure defensively, and I need to incorporate a few principles going forward. But it's a really fine line, because the fluidity and the flair that the Brazilian side has is what makes them so special. And she's like, I don't want to take that away. But at the same time, there has to be some structure, because this is a team that's qualified for every World Cup and Olympics, yet they haven't won anything. So it's like, okay, how do we layer these things in? And that's what I think about the evolution of the US, the same. It's like, okay, small little changes here and there. But that still like fits the mold of like what has made each of these nations quote unquote successful, I guess.
Who do you guys think is the biggest threat to the Americans right now? Not just specifically involving the teams at this tournament, but overall, is it Germany or France or the Dutch? Because it's funny, I was looking at where Brazil is in their tie with Canada in the FIFA rankings, and I know the FIFA rankings aren't gospel, but I think as indicated by that game against the States, like, you can see that the level of difference or the class or the level of quality is different, and the States are clearly ahead. But overall, is it Germany and France as 2 and 3 maybe?
Yeah, I think, you know, the way that the women's game is developing, there's quite a few teams, right, depending on any given day. If the U.S. can't execute, if they're starting to get frustrated, depending on the tactics the other team employs. But yes, I would agree with you. Germany, France, those teams not only play quality soccer, but they also have an understanding of what it takes to win at the highest level. Another team that I am like super curious about, and that I think is like sort of borderline scary, is the Spain women's team. They played in the She Believes last year, and I was able to cover that. And goodness, like, it is amazing to see what just putting small amounts of resources, right, into some of these countries, women's sides, does for the team, because you're starting to see all of these players play on a regular basis. Even Argentina, right, who's ranked number 31, that's playing this year, she believes, after Japan had to pull out for COVID-19 restrictions. But they just went fully professional with their pro league in 2019, and they kind of shocked a lot of fans in their 2019 World Cup by tying Japan and coming back and tying Scotland. So the smallest amount of resources right now, you just see in some of these cultures, the game is so embedded. They understand, and in some ways, it's scary how good they are. It's just about matching and becoming, or understanding, I should say, what it takes to be a true professional. And that just takes time.
So I wanted to, before we get off, because talking about other teams and whatnot, in watching Brazil, Dibinha is a stud. She probably should have had two against the US, or at least assist, if anyone else around her was kind of doing what they can. Where does she rank in these world rankings? Because you hear a lot of people, it feels like a lot of the, like, this is the top players in the world, is very European heavy in terms of the way they see the game. So it feels like a lot of players kind of get ignored, not from the women's national team, not from the US, but that play in NWSL or playing, you know, not in Europe. Where does she rank in that list to you?
Oh, I mean, she's top five player in the world, in my opinion, easily. I mean, and what's interesting is that Pia plays her, because they're playing a traditional 4-4-2. Mm-hmm. It's a little, and I'll be curious if that changes going forward, because I'm not totally sure that that's their best. You know, we can get into formations all the time and how that's played, and there has to be fluidity, and who really cares if you kind of understand positioning and like angles and stuff. But, you know, in terms of personnel, obviously you want Dibinha as close to the goal as possible, but I also would want her on the ball. And that's what makes her so special. And I think why she does so well at North Carolina Courage in the NWSL is because she is playing in that number 10, and she's good at like understanding when to keep possession. She can, I mean, the last person I would want running at the back line, and we saw that yesterday, and how much that disrupts the US is Dibinha. I mean, when players are running, the US in particular is not used to that. They're used to being passed around, and not really passed around, right, but being broken down by little combinations. But it is hard when you have somebody running at you, and of course Dibinha, that we saw that yesterday. And I mean, in terms of somebody on the ball, her ability on the ball, her fitness level to be able to cover as much ground she does on both sides, and her finishing ability, even though it wasn't as quality as we've seen so far in this tournament, She is lights out, one of the most dynamic and special players I've ever seen.
I literally stood up and yelled in my living room when she let that ball through and ran around Sonnet. Oh my God.
Right? I mean, like, I'm sorry.
It deserved a goal.
The game. Yeah, the game plan should be to get Dibinha the ball and let her run at teams. Like, and who cares if she has 20 shots, right? And that, like, one goes in. Great, that's one that went in. So, I mean, it is unbelievable.
Devang, am I allowed to close out with another fanboy question for me?
Of course, of course.
Okay. Lynn Williams. I love Lynn Williams in NWSL. I'm glad she's getting her shot with the national team. I'm glad she got a start in both games after not maybe being the most efficient in the Canada game. But there's a lot of debate about what she does well and how she fits into one of the great attacks in world history. What have you seen from her in this tournament? How do you think Vaca wants to use her, and where her place kind of stands in the full best 11, best 18, best 23?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm actually a big fan of Lynn Williams as well. I think that the knock on Lynn is it's a bit twofold and kind of funny when you think about it, because she creates so many chances on her own, kind of out of nothing, right? Just from her ability on the ball, but also her power that she has. I mean, she is in some ways so unstoppable as a player. But the knock is when she creates those opportunities, she doesn't always finish them, right? And in most cases, probably doesn't finish way more than she actually does. And otherwise, she'd be the best player in the world, in my opinion. I think it is interesting because this is still a bit of a new position as a winger for her in that three front. So I think that's important to keep in mind. I don't know if that's her best position. And I think that it's still going to take time to understand angles defensively and pressing. If she's playing up there with Carly, if she is playing, like what angles does she take to be able to press and pick off balls more so instead of getting caught out and the other teams get breaking the press. So I think there's some little movements and little efficiencies that she can still pick up that will help her in that position. I also think it's important to note too that, you know, it goes back to what I was saying early on for Vlatko and what he's using this tournament and the next couple months for before he picks the 18 going to the Olympics is that like, there's some players out there that have played together a ton. Like we've seen Megan Rapinoe and Crystal Dunn play how many games together? You could put Lindsey Horan into that mix as well. They would start to naturally and intrinsically understand each other's movements. Lynn Williams was playing with Mitch Purse. I'm pretty sure that'd be maybe at most their second game, if not their first game together, right? Then you add in Kat Macario into that mix. So there's a lot of new partnerships as well that will just take some time. And I think it's that's an important note when you get to this level, especially when you're kind of playing out of position. So, you know, with Lynn, unbelievable. And I think finish your chances. It's as simple as that. I mean, just can she become even more of a prolific goal scorer? Because that is really the only thing that's holding her back. Because even if she's taking the wrong angles that I was talking about, you know, in terms of pressing stuff, goodness, does she make up for it too with her just sheer ability to be able to and willingness to track back defensively. I mean, she covers a lot of ground for a striker and is willing to work for the team and can't say enough about that.
Yeah, you could feel it on the one she got put through against Brazil where she slowed herself up, which was that was the chance to go in on goal, finish cleanly and kind of put it all to rest. And it sucked to see, but you know, I still have my shrine set up. I'll light the candles again for the next game.
No, I like that shrine. I do. I like that shrine a lot. And it's really for a player that has worked her way into becoming one of the best strikers consistently in the NWSL and now to be like taking her opportunities. And obviously it's not necessarily always in the goal scoring category, but like other areas on the field. It's awesome. It's exactly what the pro league's for. That's exactly what you want to see from these players.
Lori, that was great. With the World Cup on the horizon, would love to have you back on the show.
Olympics, World Cup.
Did I say World Cup?
The ranks are accelerating, which, by the way,
whatever's coming out.
Good God. Okay.
I realized while watching this tournament, I hadn't thought about it in a while. We've got Australia, New Zealand next World Cup. So I'll see you guys there. That's a good one to go to.
Oh my goodness. I know. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of exciting things happening. I think just in the world of soccer in general. So I'm pumped. But yes, I would love to be back on. I could talk soccer all day.
That's Lori Lindsay. Coming up after the break, we dig into the mailbag. It's Ask AFP.
Welcome back to a football podcast, and it is now time for everyone's favorite segment, Ask AFP. Thanks to everyone who sent their questions this week. If you didn't get the chance to send in your own questions, just hop on Twitter and use the hashtag AskAFP and send them our way. Our first question goes to Egg Saladino. Great name. And whoever it asks, I guess, we'd be coming up on the GA Cup in a few weeks in a normal year. Biggest things you miss about the event that it's been canceled 2 years running, David?
Greatest question in Ask AFC history.
He's standing, folks.
Egg Saladino, praise be he. Yeah, man, GA Cup's my bread and butter. For anyone who doesn't know, that's basically the MLS Youth Championships. They host them down normally in Frisco, Texas, where FC Dallas is. And then they invite international teams in. So there's normally Bundesliga teams, a bunch of Liga MX sides, Japanese sides, Brazilian teams, whatever. I've seen some great players come out of that. As I was mentioning earlier in the show, Atletico Paranaense came when Vinicius was there. Sorry, maybe Flamengo, one of the two. And Real Madrid literally bought him, and so he was supposed to come. And there was like, you know, two Brazilian U17 internationals on the field, and he wasn't there, which is absurd because these countries are absurd. But it's my favorite thing that I do. It's a chance to watch all like the best young players, and I learn so much about coaching because they have clinics all week in between games. And so you get to see Monaco do a presentation of how they promote players through their academy. San Lorenzo come and talk about how they establish players on the national team, how you work when you don't have great conditions and, you know, you lack clean a bunch of fields and, you know, a bunch of balls and stuff like that. So it's a fascinating 10, 12 days. And it was always like a highlight of my year. And yeah, this is the second year we won't have it, which sucks, but probably not playing youth soccer where you have to travel a lot makes a ton of sense in a global pandemic. And I miss it. I will say it's where I saw Weston McKennie for the first time and Gio Reyna. And so my worry is if I don't see these young players, do they exist? And if they don't, is the U.S. Canadian pipeline slowing down because David's not there to watch y'all go down?
All right. Harold Gerald asks, great name also, thoughts on Chris Armas's coaching staff hires?
So I'm not super familiar with Javier Perez, Ian Russell, or Ewan Sharp, but these are the people that have been added to Chris Armas's staff. The quick Coles notes, Perez spent some time with New York City FC. Russell spent some time with the USL with USL's Reno 1868, and Sharp has spent time with the Red Bulls as a performance analyst, which I'm sure David could speak to. But my overall point, John Conway's thing is the goalkeeper coach. My overall thing with this is I can't really analyze how the like what does this mean right now, but I think with the old crew out and most of them joining Greg in LA, I think that those first couple sound bites you got from training camp from TFC sounds like some energy is back in the room and Chris Armas is providing a bit of an injection. And I think with this group, with what they've done, and even though it's not the full team that won all those trophies, I think they needed probably a new voice and some new faces to look at a day in and day basis. And I think the early reports in training camp is Pozuelo's happy with it, so I think I'm not surprised basically to see a positive reaction on the early days. So we'll see how the staff works out, David.
Yeah, I'll say from my point of view, it's actually was really promising that Chris Armas kind of didn't go back to the well. So when he got promoted to the Red Bulls head coaching job, he brought in CJ Brown, who was his co-captain at Chicago and was from the same kind of school. And these are three hires that are other people from outside of his pure soccer world, which I think is good because you bring in other ideas, you bring in other styles, which helps develop Chris Armas as a coach and develop inside the club. I know Javi Perez is highly thought of and was with the USU 20s for a while, as well as Real Madrid. And on Ian Russell, he's one of those names that always got mentioned in who would move from a USL head coaching job to an MLS one. A lot of teams talked to him. A lot of teams looked at him as a next potential head coach. So I know he's highly thought of as well in Reno, where, you know, they won their group last year. They've been one of the most successful clubs. So it seems to be a pretty stacked group, and it seems to be from a lot of different backgrounds, which should be key to kind of helping make a new style, as Devang was saying, in Toronto going forward.
Dave asks, making Champions League is Roma's minimum goal this season. With their bench being not as deep as other Serie A teams, should they concentrate on Serie A over Europa, even though Europa League is really their only shot at a trophy?
It's interesting because I think the last time we talked about Roma on this show was when we said Dzeko wanted out, and now he's back in and he's scoring goals in Europa League and they're doing well. I understand the question totally. This is a Roma team that's struggling to get 18s together for game days right now. And you look around Serie A, I think there's like a 6-point difference between third and eighth in Serie A. And so any team you think of that's been good, Napoli, Juve, Lazio, Roma, they're all in this convo along with Atalanta. So it's a tough situation to be in. And I would agree, and I think Roma agrees, that getting back into Champions League is massive for the future of this club under new ownership to finally get there and kind of reestablish themselves and allow themselves to spend at that level, especially coming out of the COVID pandemic. And so I would think for Roma, the key would be third place, and that would be a championship for them coming out of this year.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think just looking at their fixture list and looking at how wild Serie A has been, like percentage-wise, the smart play would just to be go for the league, because I know you have that slot through the Europa League, but a lot of good teams left still, a lot of deeper teams, quote unquote, that probably like their chances more than Roma, but focus on the league, not to say that's an easy mission. I think they've got AC Milan on the weekend after Braga midweek. So welcome. Welcome to the suck.
Devang, it should be, you'd assume even after what happened with Porto, Juve's focus is Champions League. And for Atalanta, this is a huge opportunity as well. So there should be some wiggle room in there for them to kind of at least get one of those top, one of the top four.
Well, my thing is Juve's only going up, if anything, right? I don't see them going below third. So it's perhaps Lazio, maybe even Napoli after that disaster that happened this week. But it's a good point.
And finally, a little bit of an abstract question. This one's from Clay. He tagged AFP and said, WTF in response to a wonder goal scored by Beerschot's Jan Vandenberg, who then proceeded to do a literal worm celebration. And it's not the worm dance that we all know and love, an actual worm drag. He was on the ground dragging like a worm. It was hilarious if you saw it. And since Clay said WTF, I'll interpret it as, if you scored a wonder goal, what would be your celebration of choice?
Jan Vandenberg, clearly an Earthworm Jim fan, but that was nice. Class. I think I, it's funny, FIFA, I love the, I love to run over to the coach celebration to get all my teammates involved. So I think for my wonder goal, I'd probably want to get my friends involved and celebrate with them, the classy response. But if I was trying to show people up and maybe cause a scene, I'd do the James Madison dart one. That to me is probably the cleanest, most concise, I got you celebration possible. Throw the dart. So I'd go with that.
I'm watching this right now. And the celebration is absurd. Like, looks physically uncomfortable. Like, why would you ever want to do that? I'm a big go wild person. So if I scored a big goal, you wouldn't see me for 10 minutes. I'd go into the crowd. I'd be through the crowd, out the concourse.
You're sent off, man.
Devang, this is the moments in time. No one cares about who wins the game. I'm Anthony Edwards dunking on the Raptors after I score 7 points and shoot 3 of 17.
Who won that game?
No one cares.
Who won that game, David? Who won that game?
You know who won that game? Anthony Edwards won that game, Devang. That's what will last for time.
It's true. It's true. No one cares who won the game. The game was meaningless. What Yuta Watanabe's soul being snatched is what we'll remember for a long time. That's a great end to a great bunch of questions. As always, thanks for sending them in, folks. That's it for an excellent, if I may say, AFP. A reminder to rate or review this podcast wherever you get them. That'd be great for us to get this into more people's ears. We're also on Twitter at A Football Pod. And of course, on patreon.com/AFootballPodcast. Join us today. Jump on the Discord. Grab this show ad free. For Nick, David, and myself, thank you so much for listening to AFP. We'll talk to you next week.